from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At 50, Coco Chanel once famously quipped, "We have the face we deserve." Well, maybe. Increasingly these days, at almost any age, people seem to have the face they can afford. With Botox and nips and tucks and makeovers of every variety, with chin implants and new noses and radio frequency facelifts over lunchtime. And last week, for a woman in France, a partial face transplant. The world's first, and surely not its last. If the face tells the story of our lives, our stories are getting homogenized. If the face is the theater of the soul, our souls are getting harder to see. Up next on Point, the head-turning mechanics and metaphysics of the increasingly manipulated human face. Joining me first is Dr. Robert Ray. He's a plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills, California, and appears on the e-television program Dr. 90210. Robert Ray, Dr. Ray, thank you for being with us.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great and fascinated by everything that's going on out there with the face. I want to talk about the transplant, but give us a little background here first. You have said that this whole field is just booming, that we've got more and more manipulation of the face. Give us a sense of the growth in readiness to do that.
Well, we know, Tom, just since 1997, that plastic surgery has gone up 500%. And today we're a $12 billion industry with 12 million operations per year or procedures per year. Now, in the realm of face modification, of course, facelifts have gone up about 60% since 1997. But remember, plastic surgery is divided into the cosmetic and the reconstructive. And as far as the reconstructive, last week, we reached an enormous milestone. In France, and they beat the Americans, the French transplanted, or at least a partial transplant of the face, was performed. Now, this was a lady who had been basically mauled by a dog. And
her pet Labrador, just in May of this year, her pet Labrador retriever essentially ripped off the lower part of her face.
Right. And so last week, they were able to perform the first partial facial transplant. Now, this involves, it's not just the skin. Mm-hmm. This is muscles, arteries, veins, nerves, and, of course, the skin. So this is an enormous reconstructive milestone in plastic surgery. You know, I've seen a disturbing trend in medicine in general and plastic surgery more particularly. How long is it going to be before the unscrupulous physician then does the designer face?
What do you mean by a designer face?
The aesthetic side.
What do you mean by that, the designer face? What's that refer to?
You know, it's kind of like the whole cloning situation that, once again, bioethics has lagged a bit behind. We're not far from somebody perpetrating the designer child. And
or the designer face, the Gucci face, the Prada face, the face for this season, this century.
We see it already in plastic surgery, and most of my colleagues are very, very ethical, particularly in America, and we have all kinds of governing bodies to keep an eye on doctors in America. But I have seen in my own career colleagues who do, for example, it's a very simple example, who do rhinoplasties, which are purely cosmetic, but build them as reconstructive. It won't be long before an unscrupulous, unethical physician will do the facial transplant.
Dr. Ray, let me ask you,
aesthetic reasons.
I want to welcome a couple more voices into this conversation. First, from Los Angeles, Manola Dargis. She's a chief film critic at the New York Times, former chief film critic at the LA Times, which has put her right in the middle of an awful lot of this. Manola Dargis, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And with us from Los Angeles, Daniel McNeil. He is a freelance writer and author of The Face, all aspects of the face discussed there, past, present, and maybe future. Daniel McNeil, delighted to have you as well.
Delighted to be here, Tom.
Manolo Dargis, first to you. You've paid a lot of attention to Hollywood, and this is a great big billboard for face manipulation. You wrote early this year that it was getting to the point where you just couldn't see emotion in movies anymore because it's gone so far. Is that becoming an issue in parts of the general population? Dr. A describes it as being on a kind of, you know, unending up curve around Beverly Hills in particular.
I don't know about the general population because I live in Los Angeles, which doesn't seem very
right. Doesn't seem general, yeah.
No. I would say that definitely more on the west side. I was talking about how increasingly the women all look alike to me. You know, it's everyone kind of has the same sort of pressed blonde hair, frozen faces. And for me, you know, the larger issue is really a question of aesthetics. I can't really speak to the ethical issues, mm-hmm. but I can talk about the aesthetics. And as a movie critic, you go to the films all the time, and you just see a succession of faces. Mainly, you know, we're talking about female faces, and they all start to blur together. You know, the era of the kind of idiosyncratic, unusual, great beauty, such as Betty Davis, seems to have come, if not completely to a close, seems to be closing.
You tell a story of sending a photograph from 20 years ago or so of your husband to a friend and her responding that he looks in a way that people just don't look anymore, that there's a kind of distinctive, individual, even ethnic quality that's being gradually pressed out of the population. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, I think it's the, you know, changing demographics of the United States. I mean, when you look at old photos from the early, you know, the turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th, and you see, for instance, photographs from the Lower East Side, and you just see these extraordinary faces. I mean, we are the melting pot, and there's a certain kind of homogeneity that I think that comes with that, which isn't to say we still don't have marvelous ethnic populations coming in and making it mm-hmm. much more interesting, but I have to say that it's the white face that has become really blanded out, especially in Los Angeles. I mean, you just can't tell these women apart. They all look alike. And it really has, I think, become a problem in the films. You have women who are almost interchangeable, and I can't tell the difference between all these blondes. I just can't.
Daniel McNeil, join us here. You spent a lot of time looking at and thinking about the face and its meaning. We, of course, everyone's heard of the eyes as a window on the soul. What is the face exactly? Is it the theater of the soul, or is it a billboard, a window display to be changed according to the fashion?
The face is a kind of a deep surface. It's unlike, the skin on your arm. You just look at that, and that's just flat. In the face, you see not just the skin, but you see the mind. And the face is constantly moving when you talk to people. The muscles change, and they reveal what's going on inside yourself. For instance, if you feel anger, your face will just change automatically, and other people see that. So you are in your face, partly.
You write about, by evolution, we've come to this hairless face that's very readable, and a lot is read there in all the tiny ticks and crease and bit of motion.
Yeah, if you've ever wondered why you don't have hair on your face like animals do, the reason is because the face is there to convey emotion and feeling and so forth. Before monkeys, you had animals that had hairy faces, and they had to communicate by odor. And so if you're doing that, you release odors into the air. These are really awkward communication signals. They linger for a long time, and they just really slow information flow down. But monkeys came along with a bare face, and all of a sudden they're exchanging information very quickly. And so their little society binds together much more tightly, and they become much more effective. And that's what's happened with us, too, and we're very good at it.
So when humans have access to all the technology that Dr. Robert Ray is describing here and began to numb parts of their face, to enhance parts of their face, to smooth out their faces, as Manolo Dargis says, are we cutting down on the communication that we do, or are we just communicating in bigger, broader strokes?
I think it's two things. First of all, if you really are reducing the expressiveness of your face, you're harming yourself because people find expressive faces better looking. We respond really well to faces that just show what's going on inside other people's minds. The second thing is with regard to the homogenization of the face, I think it reflects the fact that we have basic genetic inborn standards of beauty. And scientists have investigated this all over the world, and what they find is that in every culture, people in general think the same kinds of faces are beautiful. And so people here, when you get the technology that lets you change the face, people are sort of gravitating toward that beautiful face.
And with whatever advantages that brings them, but also the kind of cost in individuality. Daniel McNeil, Dr. Robert Ray, Manolo Dargis, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Shirley is calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Shirley. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm an identical twin. So a lot of when I grew up, people couldn't distinguish between me and my sister, and my face has become very important for the small little nuances and changes that I have that she doesn't. So I can't imagine wanting to change your face.
How old are you and your sister now, Shirley, if I may
ask?
40. 40, and have your faces become more distinct with those years? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yes, they have. Mm-hmm.
So you're much more easily distinguishable now.
Yeah, from little, like, childhood accidents to just the way we have mannerisms that are a little bit different is how people tell us apart.
Now, if you were to, have you done any facial surgery, plastic surgery, and the rest?
No, not at all.
And you wouldn't, do you want to wear your life history on your face? Is that?
Yeah, I do, because it's a part of me. It makes me different from Shelley, my sister.
Right, right, and the life is told right there. That's a great kind of baseline test. Manola Dargis, identical twin sisters at age 40, having the character, their life experience on their face, and Shirley saying she's happy for it and proud of it.
No, I think it's marvelous. I mean, I think I have a lovely little scar above one of my eyes that came from an accident that, you know, I remember very distinctly, but it was a very important time in my life, and it's kind of part of who I am, and it's a distinguishing mark. But, you know, I think with the movies, I think that there's such a fear of you know, deviating from some sort of perceived norm that we don't really allow people to have these kind of individual faces. I do think that we do allow men to have more individual faces, and I think, for example, someone like Paul Giamatti, who starred in Sideways, his face has the most marvelous kind of rippling effect, and he can tell you 1,000 words in one little movement of his cheek.
Right. We've got, of course, Oscar Wilde saying, a man's face is his autobiography, a woman's face is her work of fiction. I mean, there is history here. This wasn't all born overnight, but yet it's men and women doing the manipulating now. I want to bring one more voice into our conversation for a moment, if I may. Joining us from Long Island is Chuck Close, painter Chuck Close, a world-famous painter, leading figure today in today's contemporary art world, famous for his portraits, which he calls heads. He paints from photographs. You may have seen it. Many little photographs that make up the face. Well-known works include paintings of Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, Philip Glass, and perhaps most iconic of himself. Chuck Close, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So here we're looking at the face. You pay a lot of attention to it. As an artist, do you fear welcome? Are you fascinated by a society in which faces are more manipulated all the time?
I can choose who I want to paint. I don't do commissioned portraits, so I'm out, you know, looking at my friends and colleagues and family and trying to decide which ones of them I want to paint. I think if I were doing commissioned portraits, it would be I can't imagine the ego required to want to have a 9-foot-high portrait of yourself to hang around the house.
But go not so much to the issue of who you choose. We can only imagine that you choose interesting folks, but what you find in the face.
Well, I think the most interesting thing about it for me is I try to present my images straightforward, flat-footedly, without any really
editorializing
kind of emotion. Mm-hmm. But with a very neutral pose, I think a face is a kind of roadmap of the life lived. And if you've laughed your whole lives, you have laugh lines. If you've frowned your whole life, you have frown marks or furrows in your brow. And embedded in this visage is a great deal of information about the nature of the experiences you've had. And it's a kind of roadmap of the experiences and things that you've gone through.
So that's the map that people show to the world. We gain a lot from that. What about the owner of the face, Chuck Close? If they're nipping and tucking, they clearly perceive there are advantages for themselves in that, but what do you have to say about what they might lose at the same time?
Well, I mean, I think I love all the, you know, the greatest thing for me to paint are the wrinkles and the zits and the pimples and all that stuff. It's far more interesting to me. In fact, it's very hard for me to paint a young person because there's no evidence at that point of a life lived. So for me, the more battered and shop-worn and tired someone is, the more interesting it is for me to paint. So I'm not sure that, and I think most of the people that I paint have a great deal of difficulty dealing with a 9-foot-high version of themselves, because if their nose has bent a quarter of an inch in real life, they might be able to ignore that, but in a painting, it's going to be bent 6 inches. I think everybody I've painted has tried to change the way they look immediately after I painted them.
And your sense from these all these years of focusing on faces of whether, is it the roadmap, is it life experience we're staring at, or is it the core character of the person? Is it the soul even?
Well, I think people can go a certain distance in disguising how they're feeling, but... the notion that I work in photographs, the notion that you're somehow stealing the soul or whatever by taking a photograph in the first place. At this point in our lives, we've spent so much time looking at each other, looking at ourselves in the mirror, looking at images in magazines and movies and whatever, that I think we're extremely sophisticated in reading what's really going on behind. What appears to be at first a kind of frozen or blank stare, there are little indications of what people are really thinking and what they're really expressing.
So a kind of human antenna that read right past maybe the plastic surgery that you're reading there. Chuck Close, world-famous portraitist, it's been an honor to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Robert Ray in Los Angeles, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
And Daniel McNeil, author of the book The Face. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Manola Dargis, it's been wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for being along.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Manola Dargis, chief film critic at the New York Times. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.